Now we turn to major news from America's resurgent labor movement.
At the end of last week, Starbucks issued a statement that it would bargain in good faith with Starbucks Workers United, the union that represents Starbucks workers, who have been unionizing at a rapid rate since 2021, with nearly 400 stores having voted yes for a union, and more than 20 with upcoming union elections right now. The corporation also announced that it would give back pay to unionized stores that did not receive raises solely for having participated in labor organizing. While many in the labor world are dubious of Starbucks' promise to bargain in good faith after months of gridlock negotiations and intensified union busting tactics from the company, the union says that it does have reason to believe the company is good for its word. Perplexingly enough, Starbucks, along with Amazon and Trader Joe's, has joined Elon Musk's SpaceX in a legal battle to castrate U.S. labor law. Since November 16th, the company has lost more than $11 billion in revenue. Regardless of the outcome, this decision to bargain in good faith can be seen as a win for the burgeoning labor movement, as the company would not have made it if there were any loss of momentum or sign of possible rupture within the union movement. Here to speak with us about all of this is Aria Yaila, a worker at the North 7th Street Starbucks store in Williamsburg that unionized in June. And we're joined by Eric Blanc, a labor historian who has been closely following the recent developments at Starbucks and also participating in the swelling labor movement himself. Ari and Eric, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, we're very excited to have you. So, Ari, let's start with you first. Tell us what your and your coworkers' reaction to the recent news from the company was. You know, this news that we just explained, that it would bargain in good faith and you'd be receiving these back raises.
Yeah, I would say the reaction we got was pretty hot and cold. Most of my coworkers have only known our store as a union shop since they transferred in a little bit after we won our election. So they kind of know it for the association of being a shop that doesn't get all the benefits that Starbucks has been giving out since May of 2022. So when we saw the joint message from Starbucks and Workers United last week, it was honestly shocking. I had so many people coming up to me asking me if it was true. And then today we got to see the flyer go up of the joint statement in our back of house. So my coworkers are really excited. And it's not just about having a joint statement that is so powerful. It's that this is a statement that holds Starbucks to a lot of accountability.
Right. And what about Starbucks and its announced position here, leads to you to believe that they're good for their word on their stated intentions?
I think having the legioned message and having one foundational statement that was given out to all of us, not only on socials, but like in our weekly updates, and it's like on the partner network, it shows just how much they're willing to work with us.
Right, and it seems really significant that they're going to restore those pay raises and benefits that were denied to the unionized stores over the last year and a half. I mean, that's going to really open a pathway to more organizing now that you can go to other stores and say you don't have to take this kind of hit just to have a union.
Yeah, 100%. I think it's definitely going to start budding a lot of conversations about, you know, what is the union doing? And, you know, maybe I want this for my store and it won't look so much as like this union busting. It'll look sort of more of like an actual democratic decision that can be made in the workplace.
And Ari, what's the supposition? What are workers thinking as far as why Starbucks made this decision? Or what are you thinking?
I personally believe it's just an immense like frustration for them to see the momentum and to work against it. It's kind of being pressured into a position where they have to kind of rift with us and work with us because they don't see the movement stopping anytime soon.
Right. And what was it like to go through this intense period of harassment and intimidation and outright union busting from the Starbucks corporation? What was it? Did y'all experience any of that at your store on North 7th Street in Williamsburg? And what else were you hearing, sort of throughout the movement as far as what people were experiencing.
Well, absolutely. I think hearing the struggles from other union shops, especially when my store first unionized, we had about like 110% turnover right after we won our election. And I feel like that was just telling in itself the way that Starbucks is beginning to minimize the actual correspondence between union shops and outside shops that weren't union. And a lot of my coworkers felt that frustration, so they left, or the ones that joined in weren't told that they were at a union shop, and that also created a lot of division. So it definitely did what Starbucks intended for it to do and kind of ruptured the organizing a little bit.
Yeah. And how long have you worked at Starbucks, and why did you stick with this in spite of all the pressure from the company?
Yeah, I've worked at my current store for a little over 2 years, but I first worked for the company in Florida for 6 months, and then I transferred here. I did the ASU SCAP program benefit that Starbucks runs, so I could go to school. And it was my first experience in the workforce, really realizing just like the conditions that we were working under were really unfair. I'm also first generation, so I have a lot of experience of not knowing right away like what is entitled to us and like the rights you have, and kind of realizing the knowledge gap between blue collar workers, food service workers, and their rights in the workplace.
Right. And let's talk about this sort of momentum, because, you know, we've been looking pretty closely at what you and other young workers at Amazon, at Trader Joe's, at many other shops around the country, have been experiencing. And there's, you know, you've been facing increasingly difficult odds. Well, up until now with this announcement, you know, the union busting getting worse and worse to the point where you're not even getting paid the same amount. And all of this illegal activity going on the company's parts. And you're up against the most powerful people in the world. I mean, you guys are up against people like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and even Howard Schultz, you know. So how do you think that you've been able to keep momentum? Why not just quit? You know, you could just go to another job, try and get a better job, or you treat it a little bit better. What's been behind that?
I think for me on a personal level, and also just like in experience of speaking to other workers, it's more so about the kind of isolation and hyper-independence we've experienced after all of the COVID restrictions were lifted. There was a definite shift in the way we communicate with each other and the way that we're treating one another. And it just felt like it doesn't matter where you go, you're going to face these same issues where you're wondering, am I being treated the same? Am I, you know, able to look at the person I'm working with and know that we're in this together? Or am I being put up into this hierarchical workplace?
Right. And one thing I've sort of notice is, you know, you said that you're a first generation, American or USian, let's say. And I've noticed that, you know, a lot of the other organizers who are sort of leading these pushes are also immigrants, are queer, are disabled, already faced some sort of marginalization and then became aware of their marginalization as a worker. Does that ring true to you?
Absolutely. I think intersectionality in these issues is the biggest contender for getting such mass support and for bringing in all sorts of communities, is that underlying message of we all deserve a fair opportunity and equal and equity in the workplace and just to feel heard. And yeah, I think definitely there's definitely some cross intersectionality in that.
Right. And what kind of solidarity have y'all experienced from other unions and other, you know, community groups and political formations out there that have supported you?
Yeah, we've gotten a lot of, whether it's mentions or even invitations, we get a lot of like political, like local politicians always asking to help and be involved, but as well as huge on community groups and really like adopting into the fact that we are a place people go to pretty often. So we see a lot of different faces in the community of people who are you know, more connected into the things they identify with. And when they bring that to the store and they connect with us, it's just like another tidbit that we can all like come together for.
Right. And on this positive sort of moment, where do you see things going for the labor movement, for Starbucks workers that are hoping to unionize the whole company?
I think this is definitely a step in the right direction, and it's huge momentum and encouragement for the people who have been putting so much work into this campaign for the last 2 years. And I just know that it speaks to not just like Starbucks workers, but workers as a whole in general, and, you know, kind of giving union the true definition of the word and letting it carry some significance beyond, you know, more like pressure from companies scaring and union busting.
Right. And I want to pivot in this conversation to our other guest, Eric Blanc. He's an assistant professor of labor studies and employment relations at Rutgers University over in New Jersey. And he's written a couple of books, and he has a forthcoming book coming out later this year called DIY Unionism, How Bottom-Up Organizing Digital Tools and Young Risk-Taking Leaders Are Revitalizing Labor. He's also came out with an article last week for Jacobin called Seven Lessons from Starbucks Workers' Historic Victory. Eric, do you want to summarize what you see as some of the key lessons from this this breakthrough for the Starbucks Union?
Sure. You know, there's a lot of lessons. I would start off by saying that the big one is this shows the viability of a more bottom-up type of unionism than is the norm in the United States and across most of the world. The norm today is staff have to be there from, you know, the beginning to very closely direct workers. And, you know, and oftentimes this works. It's not that that type of unionism is bad. It can be effective and it can be very empowering for everybody involved. But the problem is you can't really build a mass movement that way, and you can't organize a massive company like Starbucks that way, because there's just too many different workplaces and it's too big. So, which is one of the reasons why labor hasn't even tried to organize big companies like Starbucks or Amazon. It's been workers themselves have taken the initiative on this type of ambitious, risky approach. And in the process, they've built a new model of organizing, which I call worker-to-worker unionism, essentially in which workers are both starting organizing, oftentimes without any staff support. So they're beginning the things that normally you would only do once you're in touch with a staffer, like, you know, reaching out to your coworkers, inoculating them against the union busting that's going to come, mapping out the store. Workers are doing this oftentimes without any staff support. And then also, and this is a really big new development, you have workers from every corner of the country supporting other workers over Zoom, essentially, and other digital tools, because now with these low-cost digital tools, you can have a worker in Buffalo supporting a worker in Arizona, and you don't need a staffer to do that. You can just kind of jump on a Zoom call. And so Starbucks has done this amazing, the Starbucks Workers United has done this amazing job at connecting workers with each other in a way that I think shows the way forward for all of organized labor.
Right. And, you know, sort of zooming out here for a moment, Eric, what do you think is different about now than the past? Why are we seeing such a spike in unionization and union activity across sectors? And of course, we know the pandemic had something to do with that. And like, I want you to comment on it. But I just want to note that there was also an uptick in strikes, you know, before the pandemic. So what about the economy? Has brought
right.
us to this moment.
Yeah, we've had a perfect storm. The pandemic obviously is an important factor, but as you mentioned, you know, the labor uptick really, you can say, starts in 2018 when you have this wave of bottom-up teacher strikes. And then that momentum sort of takes off with a combination of the pandemic, a very tight labor market ever since 2020, a very good National Labor Relations Board. So that's the agency that sort of in charge of labor law. Under Biden, who otherwise has been a disappointment at best, the labor law has actually been really good, and the NLRB has been really good and has helped support a lot of the organizing that's happened. And then you have the radicalization of a lot of young people. So, you know, young people who both went through these experiences, but then also probably participated in Black Lives Matter protests. A lot of people who were first organized maybe in the Bernie Sanders campaign. You have, you know, a generation of people who are probably more likely to consider themselves a democratic socialist than pro-capitalist. And so when you have that type of politics and you have a lot of those workers in these types of conditions, there's a lot of inflammable material. Public support for unions is very high. And so workers are able to use this leverage to win in a way that, frankly, was hard to imagine. Even a couple of weeks ago, people would, you know, your average person would have said, no, of course, in labor, it was said, no, Starbucks, they're never going to get a first contract. You know, behind the scenes, everyone thought they were going to lose. And there was, you know, it's very much to the credit of the workers still involved that they had confidence in themselves and confidence in their coworkers to say, no, we're going to keep on fighting. And, you know, I think they showed that there is power in workers organizing, even against the most powerful companies in the world.
Right. And in your article, Seven Lessons from Starbucks Workers' Historic Victory, you state this could become the most important U.S. union victory since the 1930s. Why do you think that is?
So to place it in context, you know, the 1930s was so crucial, not just because it led to sort of lasting union growth, which it did, but because it broke into the big corporations that were at the heart of the U.S. economy. So you, at that time, you know, you're talking about U.S. Steel, Ford, General Motors. The companies today that are like that are Starbucks, Walmart, Amazon. These are completely non-union companies. And Starbucks was the first, literally since the 1930s, the Starbucks Workers United has been, you know, assuming that this goes forward, and I do think it's going to go forward towards a first contract. It seems like there is a white flag from the company. This is the first time that workers have essentially breached this anti-union fortress of corporate America. And so there's been other union victories. There's been strikes. There's been you know, wins in the public sector. But nobody until now has shown it's been possible not just to win elections, but to get to a first contract against the biggest corporations in the world in our modern economy. And so because of that, I think a lot hinges on what happens now. So if workers see the Starbucks win and say, oh, we can do that too, then the potential for this win to spread, not just at Starbucks, but in other service sector jobs, becomes really, really high. Again, this isn't inevitable. It really depends on whether workers who are listening to this or who are reading about Starbucks win who have been thinking about unionizing but feel like it's too risky. Often it's just going to depend on them taking the initiative. And it's also going to depend on whether unions, who for the most part, despite these extremely favorable conditions, for the most part, it's been business as usual with very little investment in new organizing, sort of just standard, you know, treating it just as just the status quo. The opportunity could be missed. So I don't think it's inevitable whether this turns into the biggest win since the 30s, but the potential is there. If workers take the initiative and if unions take the initiative, not in like years, but in weeks and months, then the possibility for this spiraling into something like what we saw in the Flint strike of 1937 when they organized General Motors and then everyone else unionized, that's what we need to push for. And it's going to depend on what people do now.
And how much more urgency is there because of this court case that's making it, I believe it's taking place in Texas, but is expected to make its way to the Supreme Court that's being pursued by SpaceX, Trader Joe's, Amazon and Starbucks, basically asking for much of the National Labor Relations Act to be gutted.
Yeah, I think there's a definite urgency there. There's no world in which labor unions are going to make these gains without a massive pushback from the right wing and from corporate America. So, you know, whether it's this particular push to basically make unconstitutional NLRB, or even whether it's just the possibility and very likelihood that because of Biden's complicity in genocide in Israel leading to you know, low turnout and Biden losing to Trump and then having a bad NLRB appointed, which would also be like a very significant blow to the movement. There's a lot of pending political changes that are going to be hard for the movement to deal with. I don't think it's inevitable that any of those things happen. And I don't think it's inevitable that the movement's going to like die if some of these political changes take place. We've seen, you know, teacher strikes taking place in red states and winning, but those are huge obstacles that would have to be overcome. And so it's better to fight on a more favorable terrain. And so, yeah, there's an urgency to take advantage of the next few months. And if that happens, you know, if you have a massive unionization upsurge, more than even we've had over the last few years, then that in turn is going to make it harder for the Supreme Court to feel like they can overturn the NLRB, because they know there's going to be even bigger costs. And it's going to be harder, frankly, for the Republicans to get elected, because people will start being more polarized on class than on all the racist, xenophobic, et cetera, you know, culture war divisions that the Republicans are pushing. So I think there's an urgency for unionization, and just frankly for saving what progress exists in the United States, period.
Right. And we have to go very shortly, but Ari Ayala from the Starbucks Workers Union, we have just 30 seconds left. Can you tell us real quick how we can keep up with and support Starbucks Workers Union as you all go forward?
Yes, we have a public website, sbworkersunited.org, and you can also find us on Instagram and Twitter, and you can also sign up for a newsletter and get all of the updates that we roll out biweekly.
Great. Okay, well, thank you to both of you, Ari Ayala from the Starbucks Workers Union and on the Williamsburg, Brooklyn Starbucks store at North 7th Street, and labor historian Eric Blanc. We will be back with more after this short music break.